Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The Wake Up Call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Yeehaw! What a wonderful day out there, boys and girls. It's January 17th. And I can finally park right in front of my house and only sludge through the mud rather than the ice to get to my house. Thank you so much, weather folks. It is 11 o'clock here on Sunday, January 17th. We're going to be talking about politics. Everybody loves politics because everybody has an opinion on politics. Today's guest, Pete Ronayne, who's a senior faculty member at the local Federal Executive Institute, as well as adjunct professor at UVA, speaks and teaches on a wide range of issues, including leadership and U.S. foreign policy. Let's make sure his microphone is working.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Yay. Kristen and I got it all up and running.
Good to be back.
Thank you, sir. I thought you'd blown me off after like 12 times I asked you, and you said, no. I got to take out the trash. No, I can't do that.
Got to floss the cat's teeth.
That's right. Yep. Also, Jim Sofka, who's taught international relations in the Department of Politics at UVA. He's now an adjunct professor at the Federal Executive Institute and at the American Military University. Jim's area of focus includes contemporary politics, national security, diplomatic history. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. Good to be back.
And thank you both for being here. For those who don't know, the Federal Executive Institute is that very pretty white building just down the road from the Barracks Road Shopping Center across from Lord Hardwick's.
Correct.
Give them a little shout. Up on the hill. And you're like, what is that? Why is there that little driveway there? Pete, Federal Executive Institute.
Yes, very unmysterious. Actually, leadership development for fine public servants in the federal sector that help our nation.
And you guys have to have a huge background on a variety of things, but politics, leadership, federal and worldwide in things that are going on.
Correct. That's exactly
right. And that's really what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about President Barack Obama. Now, it's within a week, I think, of having been a year in office. And we're going to talk about what's going on out there, how he's doing, some of the issues that he's having to put his focus on. So Pete Ronayne and Jim Sofka here today. Feel free to write down the number 979-0919. That's 979-0919. Kristen will take your call and patch you through. If you need to use the toll-free line, that's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. All right, let's jump right into things. Many people would say that President Obama had come into office and had talked about spending the majority of his time on domestic issues. But he sure has had to spend a lot of time on international issues. Is that correct when I say that?
Well, presidents frequently don't get to choose. I mean, it was the same thing about Bill Clinton back in 1993 when he was inaugurated. He said he was going to focus like a laser beam on the economy. And what was one of the first crises that he faced in his first year in office? Haiti. Much in the way that we see here with Obama after the different circumstances. But international events have a way of intruding on a president's agenda. And this president inherited two wars that were going on with troops in the field in Iraq and Afghanistan and a host of other real and potential terrorist threats, especially in Yemen and other areas. So presidents, as much as Obama would like to be able to focus and compartmentalize on the economy, it's simply something that is beyond his control.
Agreed. And it's sort of a fiction to try to separate the two out to begin with, focusing on domestic versus international affairs, particularly in the context of the economy. They're so inextricably intertwined that it is a mental fiction we might carry around to focus on one versus the other, but on a range of other issues as well. And as Jim mentioned, presidents don't get to choose. One is handed a significant agenda that one has to move forward. And so the president has to naturally divide his time almost evenly across those issues.
Do you think that the president gets hard time for many people because he is focused more on the wars that are out there rather than some of the domestic issues that you know, that we're still suffering from.
My initial reaction, Rick, is actually it's probably the opposite, at least with the attention that's being paid recently, since we are coming up on the year mark, so everybody wants to grade and weigh in. A lot of the criticism of late has been maybe too much focus on healthcare, too much of a focus on Congress and healthcare, and not attention to other issues. So that seems to have shifted, at least in some camps of late. Jim?
I would say that I largely concur with Pete. The only case where that, what you talked about, Rick, became very pertinent was on the Afghan strategy review, where a number of more committed partisan Democrats were upset, arguing for more rapid timetables for withdrawal of American forces, less money being spent on overseas deployments. I mean, this is also a very old trend in American politics. Americans tend to get tired of extended overseas deployments very quickly. This has been true throughout the Republic. And Obama is in a position where he has to try and satisfy these constituencies. I agree with Pete that health care is actually the large domestic agenda is one place where some political professionals have been attacking Obama by arguing he really doesn't need to spend that kind of capital right now. Let Congress sort of percolate this bill through, and he should be focusing more on his role as commander-in-chief. But, you know, this is the famous damned if you do, damned if you don't approach of modern presidents, that no matter where Obama spends his time, and the same was true of Bush or Clinton or any other president, you're going to get attacked by somebody out there with a different agenda. And I think Obama's tried to balance it.
True, and an issue that I know certainly with undergraduates at UVA that I try to emphasize, whether it's in the context of foreign policy or presidential politics on the whole, is that not only don't presidents get to choose, but they have to deal with all of these issues simultaneously. It's easy for us to sort of balkanize the agenda, pick and choose our particular pet issue, the one we care most about, and criticize or praise a particular president for the way that they've addressed that. Recognizing that in the complexity of our society, the complexity of global affairs, of our economy, these presidents, whether it's President Bush, President Obama, or the successor, they have to deal with all of these issues simultaneously. And so when we're grading and when we're reviewing and when we're praising or criticizing, it really is an important piece of context to understand that. Granted, they ask for the job. They have a giant staff and administration to work on it, but it's all of it is happening at the same time. You don't have a lot of opportunities just to stop, to pick and choose, to cherry pick the issues that you want to deal with. And it's amazing sort of maelstrom of events that's constantly happening. And trying to, I think, forge coherence and consistency and results as opposed to just reactive ad hocery is remarkably difficult in this modern era.
We are talking about President Obama and national politics here. Pete Ronayne and Jim Sofka, both faculty at the Federal Executive Institute here in Charlottesville, as well as area universities, University of Virginia, American Military University. Guys, so you don't get to pick what you want to deal with yet. Pete, I believe you said that the health issue has been continuously pushed to the front, whether it's been done in a nice soft manner or whether it's been really just sort of pushed as though it's in the wheelbarrow, and even more so now, as and we'll get into a minute about the upcoming Senate election in Massachusetts, and there always seems to be a deadline, whether it was first it was in August and then it was in pre-Christmas and now it's before this election in Massachusetts. Is this doing anything in a good, positive manner for President Obama, or is this sort of got people dropping their heads and shaking their head in a negative manner?
Well, that's a tough one. Tactically, you could argue that in the shorter term, it's hurting more than it's helping. That's in a political sense. Of course, we want to keep in mind the millions of uninsured Americans that the administration and congressional leaders on both sides are trying to address. Critics will say, look, on the health care issue, as Jim mentioned, the notion of where do you want to spend your political capital, most Americans have health care. most Americans are insured. So real critics of the administration and President Obama's use of political capital will say you're spending that capital on a relatively small group of Americans because most aren't directly affected by that, the issue of absence of health care. But to understand it, and again, you can criticize it, but it requires the art of the long view in terms of understanding the administration's perspective. Because the way they view this, Rick, is you cannot disentangle health care from the economy. Not at all. You cannot make meaningful economic reform, budget reform, even tax reform moving forward without handling skyrocketing, spiraling upwards healthcare costs. That's a very long-term perspective, and it's harder to sound bites and package, but they truly view those issues as completely intertwined. So to your point, yeah, in many ways, it is hurting approval ratings. It is hurting some performance rating dealing with the healthcare issue up front. Number one, President Obama decided to really allow Congress and Democratic leaders to shepherd this through, not to craft his own presidential plan and force that through. So many are arguing it's taking too much time. It leaves it subject to Democrats maneuvering and packing their pet projects in there, et cetera. So there are critics of that particular tactic. But this administration is convinced that it can't be pulled out of their overall economic strategy. So strategically, we have to wait and see. Tactically, yes, it hits them. Because also critics on both sides, whether you're a progressive critic or you're a conservative critic, you can nitpick this thing to death. It doesn't include this. We can really get lost in the details of the healthcare bill and all that it contains and lose sight that in many ways, this is as monumental or important, as significant a program as really anything since the New Deal in terms of the role of government in the lives of Americans. Now, some people will love that and some people will hate it, but we seem to lose sight of how big this really is should it in fact happen.
Absolutely. And healthcare has been an issue. I mean, obviously, for the past 15 years since the Clinton administration, that's been coming and going and has constantly been discussed and proposals put forward. It's one of the reasons why there's some degree of fatigue with the issue. I mean, I think we are closer right now to systemic reform. And Pete's right. It absolutely is of a piece with the broader economic problems the country's facing. We're closer now than any time since 1970, which arguably was really the lost opportunity when Richard Nixon and Ted Kennedy were extremely close to a deal on universal health care, and it fell apart for a number of issues. I think that Obama has the opportunity to push a bill forward, if not this year, then certainly early next. But when you look at polling data, the Washington Post has a poll out this morning in today's paper that's showing that of registered voters, 24% of Americans indicate that health care, that one subject, is the most pertinent problem facing the country. Now, you could say that's certainly a lot. It's almost a quarter of the electorate is focused on health care, but that leaves 75% of things on other business. And that's what Obama and his staff is looking at as well, that this issue, while it becomes incredibly complex, cannot become the sole focus of his administration. And they're worried about embracing it too closely because Obama's relationship with Democrats on the Hill has never been particularly great. Harry Reid and especially Nancy Pelosi were early Hillary Clinton supporters. And as much as a lot of those frictions have been papered over, Obama is now a Democratic president. Obama has always been a different breed of Democrat than House leaders who tend to be more partisan, more liberal, more willing to engage in sort of loading bills up, as Pete said, with pet projects. Whereas Obama is more willing, even though he's getting a lot of flack from the right, he's actually been more willing to work with Republicans on the health care issue. And this has antagonized a lot of his progressive supporters who feel that Obama has somehow betrayed them. So health care is a tough issue. It's an albatross no matter where you get it. And it's something that Obama is going to see as a major issue, one that he has to tackle because he staked capital on it. But it's one of a constellation of political issues that's facing him right now.
It's the 17th of January here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We are talking about national politics at the moment, President Obama and where several issues stand. Pete Ronayne and Jim Sofka are here in the studio today, both faculty members at a variety of places, including the Federal Executive Institute, as well as UVA and the American Military University. So it's been a year. And we talk about the health issue, which I'm sure will come up again. But Pete, I believe you said something about President Obama sort of becoming a little less popular, fighting especially through the health issue. And he's, I believe I read in the paper, dropping pretty much everything starting today or tomorrow, going to Massachusetts to try and help the Democratic representative for the senatorial race. Edward Kennedy passed away, and now there's a Democrat and a Republican fighting for that seat. Currently is 60-40. Everyone hears that all the time about how it takes 60 Democrats to, why in the world it takes 60 to get anything done, I don't know. But that seems to be the case. And if a Republican wins this seat, now it's 59-41. Is President Obama going to be able to help keep it 60-40 by getting a Democrat elected to fill Ed Kennedy's seat?
I'm not sure that Obama is going to be able to deliver that. That's again one of those issues that's beyond his control. He's going to help. The problem in Massachusetts, and I'll let Pete is a native of the Bay State, so I'll let him weigh in on this. The problem is twofold. One is that the Attorney General Coakley, who's been very running as the Democrat, has run a completely ineffective campaign. She assumed that she would coast to victory. She did virtually nothing the entire month of December in the campaign. And Scott Brown, the Republican challenger, he's an interesting guy. He's very telegenic. He was actually a Cosmopolitan centerfold back in the early 1980s. He's played up a sort of more moderate brand of Republicanism. He's been very effective on the campaign trail. And he's tapping into what's a traditional problem, Rick, and it's one that I'm sure we'll be talking about throughout the morning, which is the tendency for the party on the out from the White House to score victories in the off year. So generally right now in 2010, by any kind of historical measure, Republicans should do well, by any model that we have in political science. And so Republicans, the critics of the administration, are more energized, Democrats are more complacent, and therefore he's gaining momentum. Can Obama and Bill Clinton, who's also been splitting his time between Haiti and Massachusetts, help the Democrats? Absolutely, they can, but they're not going to be able to pull the rabbit out of the hat if the candidate herself is simply being ineffective.
Yeah, agreed. It's an interesting race to observe because people are imbuing it with all sorts of symbolism and meaning for the administration, and some of that is important, Rick, exactly to your question, to project supermajorities, et cetera, in Congress. Those things do matter for the administration, but even more so than the actual nuts and bolts and process of legislating, it is being viewed as kind of this watershed as we hit the year mark as a sort of a referendum, an early referendum on the administration, and it, all politics is local, and Jim does point to some very important factors. People forget, number one, that Massachusetts has had Republican governors from 1990 to 2006. So while from the outside it's often portrayed as this socialist base camp in the Northeast.
Well, they voted for gay marriages are okay, right? Weren't they the first state to say that it's okay to have same-sex marriages?
And sure. the only state to vote for George McGovern.
Yeah, that's right. So yes, but the record is it's a lot more mixed than we like to make out with our red and blue states. So, I mean, a state that had Republican governors from 90 to 2006 isn't a complete loss for the GOP. And furthermore, what Jim points out is really important, that Coakley's campaign has been lackadaisical and lackluster. She has sort of assumed that I think that she would inherit the untouchable Kennedy seat, right? And that has not proved to be the case. Scott
30
Brown.
30 years? How long has that seat been held?
Oh, geez, I don't even know off the top of my head.
Ted Kennedy's held it since 62, and he inherited it. There was 2 years between it where it was originally held by his brother. Mm-hmm. It had been a Republican seat. Henry Cabot Lodge had held it all the way from the 1950s.
So at least 50 years we're talking about.
Yeah, we're talking close to 50 years with an interregnum between 60 and 62 when Jack Kennedy resigned to become president. Yeah.
So that would be a big shift. And Scott Brown is running an excellent campaign. In many ways, he's drawing from the Obama playbook. He's playing to some populist sentiment. He's getting down and dirty. He's out there pressing the flesh, getting much closer to the people that he's trying to convince. Jim's right. Democrats, after the the excitement of the Obama campaign and then victory are a bit more complacent now. Witness our recent gubernatorial election. Democrats were not fired up for that at all. And that was also in part due to the candidate. So I think there are some interesting parallels. 51% of voters in Massachusetts are independent. So there is play there, and Brown is making much bigger inroads with independent voters. And the key tomorrow is actually going to be, Tuesday?
It's going to Tuesday.
Tuesday is going to be weather. They're calling for potentially inclement weather. What we've got coming out down outside right now is going to be colder and possibly snow and ice up in Massachusetts. And so it's a question of turnout. But Republicans are energized. I can give you a personal anecdote. My mother, who leans to the right, but is an independent, and is 75 years old, hasn't been involved in politics since I think she attended a JFK, convention or something like that. And she actually is out volunteering for Scott Brown. So it's a great example of an energetic grassroots, tapping into the outside party's energy, et cetera, and making a difference. It's going to get more splash in Massachusetts because it's in Massachusetts, because it's Ted Kennedy's seat, because we're looking for these bellwethers to assess Obama at the year mark, and because there was one other issue, and I forget what it was. But for all those issues, people are going to pay a lot of attention to it. Oh, but because of the governance issue, because of the Senate majority.
All right, this is Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne here as we talk about politics. Feel free to dial up, ask your question, make your comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Send us an instant message, WNRN-STUDIO. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. It's mostly cloudy and rain today, highs 40 to 45. It's colder in the valley. It's a little warmer in Richmond. Mostly cloudy with rain tonight. Lows in the mid-30s. But mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs in the mid-50s. But only upper 40s in the valley. Right now, it's a light rain out there. 39 in the valley. 41 in Lynchburg. 49 in Richmond. And 42 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me take a moment and thank NBC 29 for their support. They have the experience you've come to know and trust for news, weather, and sports in Charlottesville and the Shenandoah Valley for 35 years now. No one likes being stuck in traffic, which is why NBC 29 HD News has traffic updates for mornings and evenings from their Traffic Cam network. You can stay ahead of the traffic with NBC 29 HD News. All right, call up with your question, comment, 979-0920-29. What the heck? Now I'm giving NBC 29 another push. NBC 29 HD News allows you to call up 979-0919. Yeah. I am such a shill. As we talk about national politics with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne, we were talking about the election in Massachusetts, which if the Democrats win, they keep their 60-40 supermajority, and if they lose, then it's only 59-41. Are there issues out there where this... I mean, we keep hearing how it's important for the health bill, but are there other issues out there where not having the supermajority pretty much is not going to allow the Democrats to get through in the whatever topic that they're trying to push?
There's a number of issues. One of the biggest one is, of course, the appointment of judgeships at the federal level and, of course, potentially Supreme Court, because that the Senate can put a hold on judicial nominees. So that's a major concern that Democrats have, is being able to have potential Republican blocks on that. And any legislation, particularly, you know, anything that's involving controversial aspects, to some extent, the discussion of economic relief bills involves, as we saw with the discussion with the stimulus package back in February, you know, the potential to need a supermajority filibuster-proof control of the Senate. The real issue, I think Pete's right, the issue here is symbolic. I mean, it's the idea that you're going to potentially lose Ted Kennedy's seat, which would be ironic given discussions on health care, since it was Kennedy who put so much effort into health care. The bigger concern for the Obama administration, though, beyond the Senate and procedural and parliamentary tactics in the Senate, is number one, a number of retirements that are coming this year, open seats, Chris Dodd being the most recent one they have to announce. This is a major that puts Connecticut in play in terms of a change in that Senate seat and the overall balance of power, House and Senate, going into November's election. Now, generally, I mean, we had talked about this, Pete and I think the last time that we were here together on predictions. I mean, the Democrats could lose by different models, 28 to 30 seats, depending upon how things break out politically between now and then. If you're looking at models, Reagan suffered a major defeat in 1982. He was down at 53% in 1982 at this part in his midterm of his first term, and then went on to win a commanding victory in 1984. So, you know, politics, you know, it changes day to day. But the concern is really, the major concern in the Senate are judgeships and any other kind of appointments for that are involving potential locks or holds on appointments, and what this is going to signal in terms of that all-important, hard-to-define political term of momentum. That you don't want it looking like the Republicans are pumped up on momentum marching into the fall's midterm election, because this could portend bad things for the Democrats in terms of the House and Senate. I don't think the Democrats are going to lose the House or Senate, at least right now. I wouldn't go that far, but their majority is going to be substantially slim, I think.
Yeah. And I think for President Obama, I mean, thinking at it at even a higher strategic level, his inclination is to govern from the center to begin with. So diminishment of majorities in either house, it's not disastrous. I mean, they don't want it. And as president, he deals with a fractious party of his own to begin with. So neither of them are as damaging necessarily as they could be. Again, given his lean towards being a bit more of a, I don't know, a pragmatic progressive, I guess is one way of terming it. So I think it's certainly something that they can navigate. But it is the symbolism, and that's what will be certainly played up across the media, because we're so we're often so narrow in focus. Jim made a great point looking back on President Reagan's presidency. At this point in his first term, he was at 53% and heading south. And when he goes up for re-election, he wins a gigantic landslide victory. So, you know, when I think about it, Rick, it's interesting. When you contacted us about the show, you know, my first reaction was, it's only been 1 year. I mean, really? Because so much has happened, and this is an administration that inherited so much and has really had to try to accomplish so much in just a year. It was actually quite surprising to me. It forced me to kind of recalibrate my own timeline and chronology.
Here's an instant message. You mentioned Kennedy and Dodd, but more Republicans are currently expected to retire than Democrats. I don't know if that's actually true. I think I heard that as well on NPR or something. But all the emphasis seems to be placed on Chris Dodd, Ed Kennedy, and how the Democrats are possibly going to lose their supermajority, but possibly even their overall majority, because all these key people as Democrats are retiring. But aren't more Republicans themselves retiring and putting their seats up for chance?
Yes, that's true. If you look across House and Senate and then even getting into state houses, yes, it's true that there are more Republicans than Democrats. And certainly the Republicans have some major potential flashpoints of their own, particularly the Florida Senate primary, where you see a split between Charlie Crist, who's a very popular moderate governor, and more conservative challengers for the nomination. So this is the problem that the Republicans will have. And they could then, and we're even seeing this here locally now, Morrow County, in terms of deciding on a candidate to run against Congressman Perriello in the fall, with the party splitting between the more populist conservative base and more moderate, as Pete would call them, pragmatic centrists in the party. This is going on. Why is it worse for Democrats, though, than Republicans, even if more Republicans retire? Two reasons. One is the broad historical theme I mentioned earlier, that momentum tends to shift in favor of the out party. So the Democrats, have being leaders right now in the House and Senate, frankly, have more to lose and more at stake. And so the stakes for the Democratic Party are higher, and there's going to be an expectation of any disgruntlement being of Obama being directed at House and Senate candidates. Second, the Republicans are generally, retirements are, with some exceptions, but generally speaking, a little bit safer in terms of their districts than, say, Dodd in Connecticut, where you're looking at more high-profile contests, at least as it's shaping up right now, where you will see potential challengers to the Democrats that are more serious than to the Republicans. Also, again, taking into account the fact that for the Democrats, this is a big deal in terms of leadership, supermajorities, protections against filibusters, and the issues that we were talking about. I think that's why you're beginning to see more panic on the Democratic side than the Republican, even though the Republicans are facing more retirements.
I think one of Jim's ending points is the key, and I don't know all of the specifics about it, but it's where the seats are. There are more GOP seats that will be in play, but more of them are traditionally going to be viewed as safe. And so you do have to look at it district by district. That's where, again, all politics is local. You know, you hop online and check Larry Sabato's crystal ball. It can give you an early indication of whether those seats are actually going to be in play at all. That's the defining factor.
And you talk about Larry Sabato. If I'm not mistaken, didn't he get every single election correct in the 2009 election except Perriello's? Or I guess that would have been 2008.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And he's taken some flack for that. But that was also a very surprising race. And that came, you know, a lot of people, not just Larry, but others were focused on the fact that Goode seemed to be in a strong position. Congressman Perriello has been targeted by the Republican National Committee. It's one of, he's sort of, you know, got the biggest bullseye on his back. The Republicans are desperate to recapture that seat. A lot of money and political attention is going to be spent in the Virginia 5th District race because the Republicans believe that they can recapture it. But it's showing in microcosm what we were talking about before is the Republicans' problem. We're focusing a lot here on potential problems for Obama and the Democrats, but the Republicans have their own problem this year. And that is, how do you keep the more populist right teabag side of the party in line with the more moderate, pragmatic, largely big business internationalist wing of the Republican Party? And that's playing out in Florida. It's going to play out here in Albemarle County. This is something, and you're seeing it every day at the level of the Republican National Committee. Michael Steele, who's the Republican National Committee chairman, is getting attacked from all sides of the party for just about anything that he says, because Republicans are divided in how best to go about this year's races. Do you go for the hard right and play the election that way, or do you try to pick off incrementally some disaffected Democrats, which means the party has to move more center, potentially center left, in certain districts? That's something that has not been ironed out yet by the Republican National Committee.
Yeah, Jim's point's a good one. Even though I mentioned President Obama having to deal with a traditionally fractious Democratic Party, which is really all over the map, probably for the first time in quite some time, the crisis of confidence and identity that was brought upon by Obama's strong victory and the Senate victories for Democrats as well is still very much underway. And you can see that in the literature of American politics. You can see it in the news magazines with a political orientation, really trying to carve out what is the future of this party and all of the different variations that can take on, being more populist, being more conservative, veering more further right on social issues, accommodating the administration. I mean, there is much more conversation about that than we'd seen for probably decades, and it has yet to fully take shape.
There's no natural leader for the Republican Party right now. That's the problem. And this is why this year is going to be tough for them, and why everybody in the party with a vested interest, from the far right to the more centrist Republicans, are going to be fighting with a vengeance to determine what the party's going to have as a platform and as a candidate going into 2012. I mean, obviously, Sarah Palin is generating a lot of media attention, but there's a lot of Republicans who do not want her on a national ticket. And there's really no center of gravity right now in the Republican Party. Dick Cheney still gets a following, but he's certainly not going to run in 2012. Same with John McCain. So the battle in the Republican Party to define who they are, but more critically, to determine candidates, is going to raise the stakes of this election. And no matter what the outcome is, even if the Republicans do very well, there's going to be a lot of soul searching between 2010 and 2012 to stake out who a viable presidential candidate could be against Obama for a second term.
11:35 here on the Wake Up Call. We are talking about national politics. Jim Sofka here teaches international relations at Federal Executive Institute, as well as national security, diplomatic history. Pete Ronayn, as well as a wide range of issues from leadership and U.S. foreign policy. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Or you can be like Blueberry671, who sent me a nice instant message at WNRN Studio. Guys, let's go back to something that's a little more personal for many people and a little more, much more aggravating, which is the bank bonuses. That's all come out in the last week, I believe, maybe 2 weeks. But in 2010, banks will be giving out their bonuses for profits made in 2009. It's currently expected to be almost $150 billion in bonuses for the top six banks or so. And that's made a lot of people angry, including the president. And he, President Obama, has talked about installing a bank tax. I don't know if that's the actual name of it, but comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the president made an unusually impassioned comment for Obama, who's not known to give into histrionics in terms of his public statements, on this issue. Because what happened is J.P. Morgan had record profits at the end of 2009, Goldman Sachs also doing very well. And a criticism that's come down from the administration is that the banks are now stable. They've taken money, they're starting to reap, some of the banks are beginning to repay some of the TARP money, but it had they haven't opened up the spigots of lending yet. So that the banks are, in essence, taking the capital that was injected into them by the Federal Reserve, which also, by the way, made a very hefty profit last year. The Federal Reserve made $46 billion, which
it's
is
its own record.
Yeah, it's a record that goes right into the Treasury. So that's good news. But the problem is that these banks then haven't turned around and started spending more money on mortgages and opening up credit card applications. That's getting money into the mom-and-pop businesses and into the purses and wallets of American citizens. Then you get the announcement that they're going to pay these huge bonuses to their top echelons of leadership. And what President Obama said, in essence, to basically paraphrase him, is if you've got the money to do this, we want the money back now. We want you to accelerate the payments of money we loaned you back into the federal government, since you're obviously healthy enough to pay these guys outrageous sums of money. And number two, we want you to be able to pay some kind of tax on that, because this was not the intention of our loaning you money. As a matter of fact, if you go back into the legislative history of the TARP actions and the stimulus package, the Democrats in Congress went out of their way to try to make sure that banks wouldn't be able to use the money for this. Now, you know, you get into some legalities over, you know, how you can enforce these pay caps. I mean, there's a whole subgenre of studies on that. Bottom line being, the president is sort of tying himself with populist anger at Wall Street and big banks. And it's going to be, this is one of those issues, I think, that you will see a compromise made, because it's going to be very difficult for the presidents of major banks to defend this. Even Republicans are not running to their support on this. It's just too toxic politically.
And at the same time, it's a difficult one for the administration to square, because, yeah, as Jim rightly mentions, you have this significant populist and just public outrage over these bonuses. And the administration can be pretty sharply criticized if they are seen as having too heavy a hand of government in every level of these corporations, even if they took federal money, that, you know, the government now is running compensation policy. That can rub a lot of people the wrong way. And I think on this issue, the administration, I would say the president in particular, probably expected a bit more of a sense of moral obligation from Wall Street for getting this right and setting things straight, et cetera, when in fact they wanted the money and then minimal oversight. I mean, I think he overexpected sort of a public service ethos from that sector, and is kind of caught a bit flat-footed on this one when that isn't their interest at all. And not surprisingly, it's just not their worldview. So I think he underestimated how quickly they would want just a return to normalcy. Okay, leave us alone and we'll get back to business, literally.
11:40 on the Wake Up Call. Pete Ronayn and Jim Sofka here. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sun. Sunday morning wake-up call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, The Hook throws out the god for our local waste war. Why are trash and recyclables up for lawsuit? Who knows? You will after sorting facts from fiction with this week's cover story. There's more information on the Biscuit Rung State Park to be. After all, local Dave Matthews Band musicians are involved. And yet another blind date challenge ends with a handshake. But the story's always exciting to read. The Hook, still tax-free. And let's thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and online at brgtshirts.com. And WNRN wants to remind you that Piedmont Virginia Community College's spring semester registration is going on right now. At PVCC, you can be ready for a technology, business, or healthcare career in just 2 years. Classes begin on Tuesday. You can get more info and register online at pvcc.edu or on the phone at 434-977-3900. There's a place for you at Piedmont Virginia Community College. All right, back in action with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne. Guys, we were talking about the proposed bank tax, since they have discovered that they're not really getting the money back as quickly or as properly as they'd hoped. Mm-hmm. And, Jim, I believe you said something about even the Republicans are having trouble saying that there's a problem with adding this tax to the list. But is it going to happen? And even the tax, let me stop for a second, because, and I don't know the proper tax percentage, but the numbers that I keep reading in the paper are that if this tax is indeed added, it brings $90 billion over 10 years as divided by about 50 firms to pay. So in the end, it's really not a lot of money compared to the amount that was given out and the profits that and bonuses that are out there.
My take on this is that it's a bit of a kabuki dance that the Obama administration is putting forward. I think Pete nailed it on the sense that Obama was blindsided by this. He thought that the presidents of the major banks would self-police, that they would never do something like this a year after getting TARP money. It would be unseemly, and that they would sort of restrict their compensation packages at least for a year or two just to make it look good. And then they don't. I think Pete's exactly right that there's, you know, this is not the most public-spirited part of the American public. And so Obama is throwing this out, I think, as a threat. Is it going to happen? Probably in some form it will. You're right. It won't be a huge penalty for these banks. They'll be able to afford it. And you're going to get some Republican attacks by saying, well, it's a new tax. Pete's right. You're going to be looking at this as government intervention. But yet it's going to be very difficult. I mean, Obama would love the opportunity to go up against any Republican candidate in the House and say, you know, you wanted to protect, you know, Larry Blankfein and others at Goldman Sachs from, you know, the tax on their $150 billion worth of bonuses. That's not going to happen. I think what he's suggesting to Wall Street is that if you guys don't police yourselves, these are things that I could do. And I could even do something more than this if I wanted to.
And I think kind of like the healthcare issue, Rick, which we talked about before, this is an example where almost regardless of where you come down ideologically, we can miss the forest for all the saplings. I mean, this issue of executive compensation in the context of $787 billion of stimulus money, bank and insurer bailout money, and automaker money. There are many people who I would argue are pretty middle of the road in terms of analysts, particularly economists, who would argue that any president probably would have done almost exactly the same things. I mean, the structural forces here in terms of the economy necessitated this action. Maybe a Republican president might have gone gone so far into the stimulus package for the shovel-ready type programs. But even in that case, no one wanted to be viewed in 2009 as Herbert Hoover, you know, just sort of fiddling and expecting everybody to find their own solution. So I think it's easy to get focused on the smaller issues of populist anger. But I would wager, and Jim, weigh in here as well, that President McCain probably would have done almost exactly the same sorts of things because of what structural forces required of a president to avoid a further slide into almost economic depression as opposed to recession.
Absolutely. I think that this would have, and certainly President Bush back in the end of 2008 essentially told Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson, do what you need to do. I mean, I'm behind you 100%. And it was Bush who really outlined in his policies at the very end of his administration what becomes the stimulus and TARP and all of these things were done on his watch. So I don't think that that's as partisan an issue. Pete's right. You could argue $787 billion versus $1.2. You know, these are trillion. These are arguments that economists have made. But I think that generally speaking, everybody agreed that something needed to be done. And I also would go so far as to say that even if it was President McCain or President Bush, you would see outrage over Wall Street firms taking outrageous sum of bonuses in early 2010 based on profits that were partly gained by money injected by the federal government in 2009. It's a broad issue.
So for what I heard there is that there will be money paid back because the banks will not argue that because there's no way for them to win against the government. Because even if Obama says, you know, this is what I think and the Republicans don't agree with that, they're not going to fight it because the overall citizenship in the United States thinks that that's a mistake.
Yeah, it's going to look like you're a referendum on greed. I mean, this isn't something that anybody wants to argue. But the bigger problem here, Pete's right about talking about saplings and forest, is that, and this is, I think, what concerns Obama and the Federal Reserve more, isn't that they took these large bonuses. That's bad. It looks unseemly. But the real issue is getting these banks to start loaning money again. It's the flow of credit. Having banks write more mortgages and issue more personal loans and small business loans. I think that there would be more tolerance, Rick, of executives taking large bonuses if the banks were seen as throwing more money into the credit sectors again. The concern is that they're not. They're playing incredibly conservative ball on the credit markets by keeping money tight money policies while simultaneously enriching their top executives. It's that double-headed argument that's really getting Obama so riled up on this issue.
And the third pet of that hydra is that overall employment is a lagging indicator. So while we might have some structural parts of the economy, I mean, think about it, the Dow is at over 10,000. Who would have thought that a year ago? Not many people, but employment still lags behind. It could be on the mend, but we're not going to see it for a while. So I think that heightens people's extreme sensitivity and a real visceral reaction to those type of compensation issues, Rick, when they feel like your average American is still imperiled in terms of their own employment.
Pete Ronan and Jim Sofka here, both from the Federal Executive Institute, as we talk about national politics. But guys, as a Republican, why aren't I talking about the fact that President Obama is so weak and so naive that he didn't even make this part of the rule? That's the problem, not as to whether or not I want to install a tax to get the money back. It's that the president didn't even have the foresight to put that into the list.
Well, one of the things he did have the foresight to do, and you can find a recent interview, and his name eludes me, I apologize, but there's a compensation czar. Feinberg. Ken Feinberg. Yeah. So he's in charge, and he's a pretty tough guy. There are people paying attention to these specific issues. But again, in Obama's deal to try to govern from the center, there were conversations, Rick, early on about minimizing that hand of government. How far is it going to reach down? Are you going to have government managing pay tables for the private sector? There are lots of Republicans who said, no way are we going to have that level of micromanagement. So, again, a real fine line and an easy one for populist discontent across the political spectrum.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to two issues. One is that it's really hard to make these rules hard and fast because you can always funnel money to people. And this is one thing that, you know, Ken Feinberg, Pete's right, he is very tough. He's the guy who negotiated the insurance policies after 9/11, the compensation for all the victims. So, I mean, this is somebody who is used to getting through very complicated and very sensitive data. And the problem is, how do you actually regulate who gets paid what? And also, I think the issue Pete brought up earlier, Obama didn't think it was necessary to make a rule because he never thought that these guys would do something like this. He assumed that they would sort of be gentlemen and they would sort of take it on the chin for a year or two, let things settle out, and then they can go back to making their money. And again, you know, none of these guys are, you know, if they don't get these bonuses, they're not going to starve. So I think that the fact that the issue wasn't raised as aggressively, one, because of procedural concerns, but how would you actually do it? And two, because I think Obama saw more buy-in from the banks in terms of his overall approach. And I think that'd be true, to go back to our argument, McCain would probably be even more furious than Obama on this issue, I would predict. Mm-hmm. And I don't think George Bush would be all that happy about it either.
We got Charlie here. Hey, Charlie.
Yes.
Fire away.
All right. It's two things. One, with the banking and the TARP and the ease that some of the banks have found to repay the TARP back. Wondering if there's discussion of them, those banks that found it so easy to pay back the TARP money. You know, the discussion was at one point was they were forced to take it in the first place. So it's, you know, I mean, that's just open for discussion because there's no proof of anything. But then also the banks are, especially the banks that are paying the bonuses, are farming more and more of the work out of the country. So they're actually reducing revenue for the government, and yet the government doesn't seem to even highlight that at all. But there's been tremendous job loss in the banking sector, and much of that job loss is work that doesn't have to be done. It was work that was sent, you know, to a you know, an outsourced entity in India or wherever, that where the workforce can do things much cheaper. But that's not even being discussed or commented on.
All right, well, let me give the guys a chance to talk about it. Thanks for the call.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Charlie's got a great question and makes some good comments there, and two quick answers to his points, although they require a lot more analysis. The first is, not a lot of the banks were forced to take TARP money. The reason why it was easy to repay was because, again, it goes back to my earlier point, they're not spending money. In essence, the criticism is they took this money and they hoarded it and they invested it and they straightened out their books and they got rid of bad assets, and then they sat on it and they grew a pile of money as the stock market and financial sectors went up, so that they're not reinvesting that money at risk into the mortgage market or small business loans or other areas that can generate employment. So the banks are basically getting fat and happy on this injection of capital. On the outsourcing, yes, absolutely. The banking sector has moved some call center jobs and other financial transaction instruments out of the United States, which, again, reduces their overhead and thus makes it easier for them to make big profits. Now, the counterpoint to this, and there has been some attention to this, by the way, actually, that is not something that's surprising to members of Congress, and there has been, as part of this review, this discussion about outsourcing is part and parcel of the broader bill that Obama proposed on this tax on bonuses. There is sort of an attempt to sort of dot I's and cross T's on these issues. The counterpoint to this is, look at what's going on in the UK. Gordon Brown's government passed two laws, one that was very restrictive on the amount of bonuses that banks can get, and the second was that jobs had to stay in the United Kingdom. So you see in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, also in France, a tendency to prevent outsourcing of jobs, and second, to sharply restrict compensation and bonuses. These have been actually used and discussed as potential models in the United States of what we should be doing here. But it gets back to what Pete was talking about, less emphasis on regulation and taxation, more willingness of states to intervene in the economies in Western Europe than here. But both of your questions, Charlie, are spot on. They have been seen and understood. And the big issue is, one, getting those banks to start opening up and loaning money, and two, attempting to try and restrict where they can put jobs and how much they can outsource out of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Just to build on what Jim said, I think both of those issues, outsourcing and compensation, they are miniature third rail issues for a Democratic administration to be viewed as too much of a statist, this administration, they've already been labeled socialist up to this point. So you want to be, you're going to be very careful about intervening powerfully and dictating what percentage of jobs have to stay at home, what jobs can go abroad, because that is not an invisible hand of government. That's a very, very visible and heavy hand of government in private sector. They're going to be very, very wary of that, right or wrong, and we can disagree on that.
It is 11:55 here on the wake-up call. I do need to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for allowing us to be here today. If you want to keep warm and have fun, Blue Ridge has the gear for you. Whether your outdoor adventure is winter running, hiking, climbing, or snowshoeing, Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville, the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen, online, brms.com. And in case you didn't know, we are talking with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne here, WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Why does everybody call in the last 10 minutes of the program?
Because they've been riveted. That's why.
Caller, how are you?
Hello.
Yes, fire away.
Yes, I don't have a more of a comment, but a request to contrast from the scholars and of your show there, but I have this photograph of the president of Iceland. I don't know if that photograph was that you saw that with the citizens of Iceland with their red flares surrounding the presidency with the currency collapse and the banking response from the citizens, and how it's at this point in our history that the banks with these bonuses have come out, and it seems to be a public relations repeat of this cycle that we seem to be going through. And my I guess in contrasting with that photograph, with what's happening with that refusal of the grassroots, you know, to pay these banks back, currently the United States and American banks are going to get ready to dump all these houses out on the market. I've heard 600,000 or some figure of that. At the same time that these houses are becoming teardowns, and then the oncoming result at this time I see also coming is this the commercial market. We're entering the stage now where we've sort of worked our way through the residential real estate market, and then an ending. I'd ask the oncoming I see is the real estate in the commercial area.
All right, Charlie, I'm going to let these guys answer because we're down to the last couple minutes.
Much.
All right, thanks. Gentlemen?
Well, first I'll just say that I appreciate any caller that first refers to us as scholars and references Iceland. That's pretty rocking. I think, I don't know if this answers the caller's question, but one thing that is relevant is I do think, and Jim mentioned this before, kind of President Obama's generally calm demeanor. I do think on some of these issues involving bank bailouts, a potential flood of houses, even the healthcare issue, looking ahead, because that's part of end-of-year reviews, it's also being prospective and looking to the next year. I do think that the president on these issues could show a flash now and then. I mean, I know he believes that this cool demeanor is part of injecting calm and stability into the overall system. But I think when he shows a little bit of his own sort of populist teeth and motivation, that he sort of feels average American pain would be very, very helpful and hopefully prevent people with flares out in the streets.
Yeah, I mean, the concern that the caller raised in terms of Iceland gives you an example of scale. I mean, the entire country almost collapsed, I mean, around the banking problems in Reykjavik. So here, Iceland is always the case that I sort of invoke of, you know, when you think it could be worse. I mean, there's an example of where it could be much worse because you were dealing with a smaller market and more concentrated breakdown of wealth very quickly. And so Iceland is certainly what we don't want to become. In terms of the caller's second point, I agree, and I've read this as well. This is a potential drag. The commercial real estate sector, which is projected, you know, large. You see it here in Charlottesville, Albemarle County, and nationwide. Large amounts of open office space, rentals declining. Is another part in what we were talking about earlier of trying to get banks to make more loans so that you can begin to create businesses, hire ventures that can become capitalized. That's a big problem for this year.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff we didn't even get to. And
always is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a year in 1 hour, Rick. I mean,
that's right.
All right. Because I really wanted to get to the national security issues that have happened at the end of the year and taking the president's eyes away. But we'll have to wait for another time. It is noon. Time to turn it over to my man, Drew Thompson. Thank you so much, guys. Jim Sofka, Pete Ronayne.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
The Federal Executive Institute. Drew Thompson up next with Les Temps Purdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.